I am just going to talk to you a little bit. Some of the slides might hit on some of what people have said. I'm not going to go through that again, but really talk about what states are thinking about. What are we challenged with as we move forward with healthcare reform? And what are sort of the provisions and where we need your help? And I think first, the two words, the thing that I like to say, and as I start every presentation, is one, we have to have patience in this process. We do have work ahead of us, 3.5 years plus, as rules and regs get defined, that just because we passed healthcare reform on March 23rd does not mean everything is better on March 24th. And I will tell you, there is definitely that expectation that everything is better, that our premiums are going to go down, that we're going to see changes in the system. And it's going to take time, because it's taken us time to get to this point. So it's important to remember it's going to take us time to get away from this point. So it's really important as advocates that you help sort of set the right expectations, the right frame as we move forward about how we work together. And that second part is we really need to be engaged in this process. Yes, that 15 months that it took to pass the bill was challenging and partisan and all these kinds of things. But to implement healthcare reform and do it well, we have to do it together, and we have to do it in a nonpartisan way, sort of bringing together all sectors. That's really been a priority of Governor Ritter, and I will say of Governor-elect Hickenlooper coming forward, that really to have the diverse voices, people that agree and don't agree at the table, because that is the way that we get to where we need to get to, that we identify both the intended consequences and the unintended consequences as we move forward. The second thing you have to really remember is this bill's not perfect. Some would say that this isn't even the bill that was meant to pass. This is what came out of the Senate. There was going to be a House version. There was a House version. It was going to go to conference committee. And politics sort of happened, and so it didn't. And so recognizing any piece of social legislation we've had, whether it be Social Security, Medicare, Medicare Part D, has never been perfect the first time around. And so really, again, this is about all of us working together and taking these messages back to our community, that this is about us working together to improve this bill so it works better for us going forward. And again, as folks that work directly with people impacted with mental health issues, that you are some of the best voices to help us figure out how we better integrate mental health into healthcare and how we move this forward and deliver this in a way. And really, I think what healthcare reform was about was, okay, sure. Just IT challenged. Is really about sort of helping people understand that it's passed and what are the big provisions, but really providing that right framework about healthcare reform is really about improving the health. For us, it's about improving the health of Coloradans by 2020 is sort of our frame that everything fits into. Because each piece can feel like a separate and diverse piece, but really this is about working together and trying to break down some of the silos that exist within state government, within federal government, so we can deliver healthcare better and really get value. And I think that's core, that we need to figure out. Healthcare reform was really about business as usual is no longer acceptable. And by that I mean insurers can't continue to deny risk. Individuals have a responsibility. That businesses need to stay in the game, and if they don't, that there's going to be a penalty. And then providers, we need to deliver care differently. It isn't going to be fee-for-service world going forward, that anything you do will get reimbursed. It's really about changing the dynamic to say, how do we bring in value? How do we bring in health and wellness? How do we reimburse for better things so that we get better outcomes? And so that's really the context that I want to give you for the rest of this. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of what they've talked about, but really sort of the Colorado context. So states have the opportunity and will be expected to expand Medicaid eligibility to 133% by 2014. States also have the ability to move ahead prior to that. So we passed something called the Provider Fee, Colorado Healthcare Affordability Act, which actually by 2012 will take Colorado up to 100% of federal poverty for these same populations. So for us, going to 133% wasn't as big of a proposition because we had already figured out a funding source. This is a hospital bed fee where we have then used that money, matched it with federal dollars, and then one, improved reimbursement rates for hospitals, both inpatient, outpatient, and for their indigent care program. And then secondly, expanded eligibility. The first expansion happened in May. We expanded to kids and pregnant women to 250% of federal poverty, and we expanded to parents to 100%. And so that's meant about 27,000 people that are now eligible in Colorado that weren't eligible before. And this makes a huge difference. And so we did talk. This is about coverage. This is about insurance reform. But if you look at health indicators, having health insurance means you have better health outcomes. Now, it's not the whole ball of wax, but it is an important thing, knowing people can get the care at the right time when they need it. And so there's a lot of opportunity in that. And we should just recognize what this expansion to 133% really means. Because what I'll tell you is the way Medicaid has worked has varied state to state. So if you're eligible in California, that does not mean you're eligible in Colorado, does not mean you're eligible in Idaho. And it really depends, sort of as a state, how you view that population, because it's been categories or populations. And so as states, we've cared a lot about kids. We've cared a lot about pregnant women. We somewhat care about their parents. Disabled, well, we're still, you know, we're figuring that out. And then adults without dependents, eh, you know, not so much. And so fundamentally, just to recognize what this means is that every state, the eligibility is going to be the same, the income disregard is going to be the same, and again, it doesn't matter how you got to that poverty level, you are going to be eligible for a public program. And so I think it's important not to lose sight of that, because that is big for the populations that we work with. In Colorado, it's about 500,000 people that are going to be now have coverage that didn't have coverage before. About 200,000 through the expansion of Medicaid, and 300,000 through the exchange, what we talked about. There are about 300,000 people that will be eligible for the subsidy that are currently uninsured that will now be able to purchase health insurance. So it's a great opportunity for Colorado, especially as you think about 800,000 people being uninsured, 770, depending on which data set you look at, and we're gonna cover about two-thirds of those, which is huge again. Increased funding for community health centers is what I also put in the bucket of coverage, because again, cards don't always mean people have access. So there are a lot of investments in access points as well. And so, and it's important to remember, I wanna be clear, that these are federally qualified health centers, a huge part of our safety net, but not the only part of the safety net. So it's important as states that you're having discussions not only with community health centers, but the other pieces of your safety net. So rural health centers, clinic net clinics, which might be faith-based clinics, because I think that everybody, each community goes to the clinic that serves their needs best. And so we need to figure out how to integrate our services in all of these. And as a state, we've been having discussions with all of our parts of our safety net, mental health included, to make sure that as this funding comes into our community and their capacity is doubled, that it's not competing with other clinics. Our goal is to expand capacity total, because really, to meet the need of the 500,000 people, we need to not only just have the providers we have today, but we need more than that. And so how do we make sure that this growth is systematic and strategic? And then I'll say there's increased funding of workforce, both through student loan repayment, nurse educator repayment, mental health providers can get repayment to go into underserved areas or medically underserved areas or serving medically underserved populations. So again, Colorado has been able to take great advantage of this. There was dollars in ARRA as well. We were able to get second to California in drawing down student loan repayment and hope to continue that going forward. Because again, this is how we know we address some of the shortage. And I'll say, I think I probably put it on another slide, IT, but IT fits in both coverage as well as, I would say, cost containment. Because as we talked about IT, it's about the sharing of information. And I'll say it's not only going to be important for us to have these personal health records, but it is really the sharing of information that's going to make the biggest difference for us. Because if providers don't know what other providers are doing, we really haven't done anything but turn a paper folder into an electronic folder. And so again, that's going to be key, is sort of how we share this information. And I'll say this is also a challenge, and something as a mental health community need to be thinking about, is how we share mental health information, because there are some barriers to that sharing of information, both at state and federal levels. And we need to be safe and secure in the way we share our data, but we need to make sure that it's just not physical health data that gets shared, but mental health data that gets shared as well. Some of the cost containment, and I tend to hit on cost containment a lot, and I mix a lot of the quality, cost, pilots all together, because really the name of the game is cost. If we do not figure out how to contain costs for states, for the federal government, for individuals and businesses, we're not going to be successful in this. Again, the things you're seeing on the paper now are premiums are going up. And that's where people are focused. And so we need to really figure out, this is really the charge to us. It was less defined in federal healthcare reform. I'll say there are a lot of pilot projects, a lot of opportunities, ways for states to take advantage, ways for you to get involved in these pilot projects to make sure they're done well. But then there's a real responsibility to make sure that we turn these pilots actually into policies. We actually make sure that we actually implement them. And there's a lot of great projects. We've done some great things around transitions of care, where the University of Colorado developed a model with Medicare seniors transitioning out of being discharged from hospitals. If you do one in-home visit, and two follow-up phone calls, we've been able to reduce readmission rates by 50%. And that's huge. But what I can't tell you is how that works for the Medicaid population. I can't tell you how that works for the privately insured. And these are what these pilots help us do, is figure out what's going to work sort of across payer sources to help us figure out how we address some of these cost issues. Accountable Care Collaborative is another one that was talked about, really about how do we get providers to come together in a region to figure out how you're delivering care in that region and what changes you can make. Again, in Colorado, we know in the Eastern Plains, the C-section rate is 7 times higher than the rest of the state. And I will say, as a state, we have done a terrible job about sharing data back with providers. And healthcare reform requires that now to be done better. But I think as states, we're recognizing the importance of that. But 7 times higher, it's hard to explain. You can say some of that's rural. You can say some of that is consumer demand. But fundamentally, there's something that's not working. And so how do we look at that and deliver care differently, which will both save costs and improve patient outcomes? And that's really the focus. It's about improving patient outcomes and getting the right care at the right time. So again, we've talked a lot about chronic care management, increased funding for home and community-based services. We've been a real leader in home and community-based services in Colorado. We took a little dip, but now we're getting back up on the positive swing. Money Follows the Person is a grant opportunity. We are going after that. Many states have to really invest in home and community-based services. We have some recommendations from our disabled community about sort of around the Olmstead Act. And so we're hoping to use that money to actually implement those recommendations and have shown to save money as well. And then the telehealth network, I want to recognize George and all the heart and grade work that he has done. While mental health wasn't included in ARA and sort of the way we do it, we have as a state, and because of George's leadership, have really been able to make sure that mental health is at the table and will stay at the table going forward. And I don't want to leave out rate review as well, because we don't always talk about that, but there is a lot of increased funding. We got $1 million, many states did, to increase the Division of Insurance's capacity to look at insurance rates as they're being proposed and make sure that they are accurate and true, that insurance companies aren't necessarily pricing up to prepare for healthcare reform, that the rates are actuarially sound. And so it's important to pay attention to that process as it goes forward as well. Going backwards. Created an implementation board. Many states have created some kind of board, some kind of director of implementation. So I got a second job for half the pay. It's very exciting. But really, it's the charge of this and the board and the director is really important. And I'll say it's going to be very similar from state to state, whether it's your director of Medicaid, whether it's your director of insurance that's doing this, or it's somebody within the governor's office. And it's fourfold. One, an implementation plan. Before the election, I don't even actually know the count after the election, there were at least 20 governors who were termed out or not seeking re-election. Governor Ritter is one of those. Many other states were going through this, and I don't know what the final count is, but at least probably half the states are transitioning. This is the same time healthcare reform is moving from a federal level to a state level. So you're having a change in all your cabinet members, likely. You're having a change in staffing. All the people that have been thinking most about healthcare reform aren't necessarily going to be there come January. And so it's really important as we transition that we leave this roadmap, this blueprint of what's been done and why, so that you don't have to start all over. So what are the partnerships? What are the collaboratives? And to make sure that that work continues is going to be really important. Outreach and engagement to stakeholders, again, that was important to Governor Ritter. It is very important to Mayor Hickenlooper, Governor-elect Hickenlooper. I still don't know what the right term is. I'm in this transition period as well. To engage stakeholders, again, I talked about this, that your voice is so important. And so really figuring out, there is an implementation director in almost every state. And so if you're not sure who it is, my contact information's in here, and I will try to connect you with that person. But every state has this implementation director, and so it's important to make sure that you engage with them and let them know what is working and what isn't working, and stay involved in the process. Transparency is important for most states. How do we make sure everybody knows what we're doing? If you go to our website, you'll see the grants that we've applied for, the information, the letters we sent to Secretary Sebelius, moving ahead on the high-risk pool, all of these things, it's important for us to be very upfront. And our health reform website is colorado.gov/health reform. It's on the last slide, so you'll get to see that again. Going after grants, I actually put together a spreadsheet. It's also on our website. There are 20 pages of grant opportunities for states in healthcare reform. That's a lot. I'm not sure if any of you have had the opportunity to apply for a federal grant. It's a very exciting process. And typically, as has been said, it has a 30-day turnaround, which is also challenging because our goal has been to engage stakeholders as we go after these grants, identify what are the priorities for the state administration, but also the departments, because really to go after a grant just to get the money isn't really a strategy we were hoping to follow. It doesn't make sense because writing the grant is the easy part. Actually implementing it, doing it well, is really hard. So you got to make sure that it's a priority. You got to make sure that it's sustained. And so for us, we turned to our foundation partners and saw where they were investing dollars. We turned to our community partners and figured out where their activity was going so that we could leverage that and then figured out what we could do and go after as a state. And it's meant we haven't gone after every grant. One of the grants we didn't go after, where I think also a lot of consumers were disappointed, was the consumer assistance grant, the Ombudsman grant. And the reason was not political in our state, was that we couldn't get all of the consumers on the same page about, in a 30-day period, about what was the right assistance programs, Ombudsman program. And because it only came with 1 year funding, how you make that sustainable, especially in short time, budget shortfalls. And so we just had to make a hard decision. And so this is actually just also another value that we need to take going forward. We sometimes can get stuck in the way that we do things, that this is our frame, this is what we need to do, and we need to really sometimes step out of that and think about how we could do things differently and better. And that means sometimes we have to give up what we do as an organization or give up the way we do things. And so it's challenging to get that new frame, but really it goes back to this requires us all to change and figure out how we do things better. And then the last is really coordinate state agencies. I'm sure in your states it's not this way, but some of our state agencies are a little siloed, and they don't always talk as well to one another as they could. And healthcare reform really requires us to work together in ways that are much different. It requires states to work together with the federal government in much different ways. And so it really gives us that opportunity to engage agencies in new ways. So we can start talking about mental health, even though it's delivered in public health, even though it's delivered in human services and healthcare policy and financing. How do we do it differently and better through these pilot projects? How we do things differently around early childhood programs, how we do things differently around the exchange. And so it is a great opportunity moving forward. So I wanted to talk about quickly about a few of the things. So one of the new things we created was a new high-risk pool. Every state was required or the federal government would do it. And so it's important not to lose sight of this because I will say there are a lot of folks with depression or mental health issues that have not been able to get health insurance because they are denied because of a pre-existing condition. And so we know that went away for kids, and I'll say it's not perfect even with that because there was no, the piece that it was missing, again, this goes back to the law is not perfect, is it doesn't require every insurer to offer child-only policies. So what it has said is if you offer child-only policies, you can't deny. And so we've had a problem and have had a lot of discussions at a state level with our insurance carriers because right now we only have three of them offering child-only policies. So it means that the high-risk pool is still going to be a valuable resource for kids with mental health or other pre-existing conditions. So in your states, just recognize that while you cannot be denied for pre-existing conditions as a child, there are some tweaks to that. And so need to, again, think about these complexities and how do we fix them going forward. This is really, these high-risk pools are meant to be a bridge. So we had an existing one, Cover Colorado. We partnered with Cover Colorado and Rocky Mountain Health Plan to create this new one. We brought together stakeholders and said, what's important to you? And what we heard is seamlessness. Most consumers aren't going to know whether they're insured for 6 months or not. They just know they need health insurance and want to try to find something affordable. So if you either go to this website or our Cover Colorado, there's a set of questions and it will automatically take you to the right website. I think that's why you'll see our state high-risk pool is one of the more successful in the country. That I think it was the Washington Post just came out with an article saying that they need to make some tweaks because this is not working as well. But we've been able, again, to work with our state partners. We've had 470 people get enrolled since July 6th. So again, we're doing a lot of outreach to make sure people know about this. And specifically, she has openly shared her stories, but I still wanted to give her some anonymity in case she wanted it. But again, not been able to get insurance because of depression. And so this new high-risk pool has meant she's gotten coverage and she doesn't have to worry about going to see a doctor when she needs to go see a doctor. The exchanges we talked a lot about, this is again a place for you to engage in. States are in different levels of implementation of this. We were probably one of the first states to move ahead with a stakeholder engagement process. But every state is going to be required to do this, so making sure that you know about when those meetings are and can participate so that your values are heard, I think will be really important. We've did 9 of these community forums. We started the question with a successful health insurance exchange will, so that people could give us a sense of what they wanted it to be. Because once you define what you want it to be, then it's easier to answer the questions about governance. It's easier to answer the questions about how you sort of, where you put things. What are the benefits that are covered if they're not covered in the essential benefit package? And so it's really important to participate in those. We're developing a perspective brief that we can also make as part of this transition document. These are some of the things we've heard to date. One, how do we better organize the market? I, as a consumer, can't figure this out. Or as a business, I can't figure out sort of how I make these choices, how I get information, and how I can figure out what works for me. Transparency is really important. Affordability is really important. Information, getting through multiple sources. So it's not just a navigator. It's not just going to be a broker. But how do you use peer organizations like Mental Health America of Colorado? See, I'm still working on the branding so that I don't mess that up. You know, or George's community health center. So folks with mental health can talk to folks and figure out what's the best insurance plan for me. How do we have meaningful choices? Choice has been very important, but a lot of people pointed to Medicare Part D and said there were way too many choices there. Can we sort of scale it back a little bit? We want choice, but we want meaningful choice. How do we get value? How do we maximize participation? So that's not just from an individual level, but if we don't have insurance companies participating in the exchange, we're not really going to have a successful exchange. So it's going to be really important to maximize that participation, but also minimize adverse selection. And what that really means is we have to have a healthy risk pool. If you have just unhealthy people in there, it's not going to be successful. In some ways, that's what our high-risk pools are. And this is really about transforming and saying, how do we create sort of this healthy market where people can sort of get a break on administrative costs, but know that they have ongoing health insurance? And so some of this is going to come into play. We've talked a little bit about this mandate. So every state has their mandates, but we're also defining an essential benefit package. If what is defined at a federal level doesn't include everything that we have in state mandates, we're going to have to do some reconciliation. If you add anything to the essential benefit package as a state, there is now a state cost to that. So again, it's important to recognize how this essential benefit package gets defined will be the benchmark for a lot of states. Because I will tell you, a lot of states don't have a lot of money right now to be able to pay for the coverage for the subsidized population. So again, when I was talking about 300,000 people who are eligible for subsidies in the exchange, that's who we as a state would have to pay for those additional costs on. And so states are going to be looking at that. And I would also say that the other part is, they definitely have said in the essential benefit package, there's going to be mental health. They've said that there's going to be substance abuse. They've said the USPTF A and B recommendations. But what I will tell you is the scope and duration has not been defined. And so that's going to be a really important place to play. And especially because the USPTF recommendations A and B are screening recommendations. They're not exactly health insurance coverage benefits. And so translating that is going to be very important. I'll say as we looked at mammography at our state level this last year, that definitely came into play, and tobacco cessation as well. So just it's something to be thinking about as we move forward. And then maximizing seamlessness. People are going to move between that 133% and that 134%. And how do we make sure the provider networks look the same or they can count on benefits? You know, how a person transitions between public and private is going to be even more meaningful as we move forward. So, again, talked about a lot of that. Most states will be running legislation this year, really especially around governance or who has the authority in your state to move ahead. Because there are 48 states and or territories that have received up to $1 million, we got $999,987 to start looking at health insurance exchanges and what we do, starting to do the actuarial analysis, starting to look at what these markets will look like so that we can apply for bigger grants going forward. Again, there are challenges, as always, in everything we do. Healthcare reform comes with a lot of funding, but I will say not with any administrative funding. So work that we do at a state level, the staff that it takes to implement, isn't really there, and it is challenging in tough budget times. I will say we've been, again, very fortunate to have foundation partners to help us support in some of this effort. Timing doesn't always align. We talked about 30-day turnaround in grant opportunities. That doesn't always work so well for states. But, we need to figure out how to do this. The high-risk pool was another great example where we had to create a brand new insurance policy in 90 days. That was challenging for states to do, but important for us. And then changing relationships. We talked about the changing relationships between agencies, between states and federal government. And again, just want to echo that the cost containment and the pilots to policies is going to be really important, as well as patience moving forward, and your continued engagement. So thank you.
Well, thanks, Larez. I think to get some concreteness about this is really a useful lesson, so thanks. So finally, we will have George Del Grosso respond to these many, many pieces of information that we've learned here. George, as I said earlier, is the CEO of the Colorado Behavioral Health Council, which is our association of behavioral health organizations across the state. And he's also for a long time center director, so he knows how to do this from the real grassroots level. So we look forward.
Thanks, Gene. Boy, this is a tough lineup to come up after, I'll tell you that for sure. But what I think maybe it is good that I was at the end, because I think that what it helps with is try to make this practical. How do we make this real? And I'm sure that you've been to several workshops in the last few days that have had pieces of what you've heard today and trying to put that into play. And I think there's some things that we need to start out with together, and that is to share that, there's some things that we know, but there's a lot that we don't know. And as things evolve in front of us, as we see policy roll out, as we see how it works on a practical level, we're going to have to do a lot of doing and learning. And that's not sometimes so easy for people to do. They sort of like to be able to walk down that pathway and know they're not going to hit a bump in the road or have a tough time. And frankly, that's not our reality. And particularly as we start talking about putting the mind back onto the body. And that is including behavioral health as part of physical health and looking at the person as health. We just had a wonderful opportunity last night. We were on public television. We were on Channel 9 News, and we had about 30 of our therapists that were online, and we opened up the call lines for people and encouraged them to call in. And we were the whole night was about health, or mental health is health, and to start reaching out into the communities and to begin trying to take the enigma off of this area of healthcare. It's really sort of sad. Now, somebody in their wisdom at some time decided we were going to manage mental health over here. We were going to do it this way. We're going to do physical health over here. And I think that we thought it was a good idea. Now, I've been in the field for 35 years, and so I might even have been around when some of those decisions were made, so I can't always blame it on others. But the point being that it seemed to be a good idea at the time. I happen to represent all of the mental health centers in Colorado and all of the behavioral health organizations. And so in Colorado, I have this unique perspective. We have all of these nonprofit mental health organizations that cover the entire state. And then we also have managed care companies who manage our Medicaid mental health benefit and been doing that since 1995, and it's been extremely successful. And I'm talking about access, I'm talking about money and those kind of things. But as we look at that together, we've got to start saying, how is this going to be different? How are we going to change, and how are we going to make this work? And so I want to share just some of those thoughts with you, if I can, this morning. One of the major differences is us looking at the whole person. I can tell you that when I was trained back in the early 70s, we were taught to ask physical health questions. It was on the mental status exams. You'd sit and you'd check off the boxes. And I was a good little therapist, and I checked those boxes off. I had the information. The problem was I didn't do anything with it. It was just sort of sat there. And there may be a time that I would somewhat see, oh boy, yeah, depression. That sometimes has to do with a physical problem. And you might encourage the person to go see their physical health doc. But it really, really wasn't a big part of what we do. And so you're going to see a change in the way that behavioral health is provided. That those questions about people's physical health, that information about people's physical health is going to be a core component of how we provide care. Now, I want to tell you, this is a real radical thought. 2.5 years ago, my board said to me, go look in the future. Tell me what's out there in the crystal ball. Well, I went on my mission, and I'm going to tell you, when I came back, I was terrified. I says, oh my goodness, the way that we have been doing care, the way we have been structured, is in dire jeopardy. At the same time, I was more excited than I have been in a lot of years about the potential and the opportunity. Our first two presenters, I know Larez, you did too, you're laying out all these opportunities that are there. I'm thinking, how in the world do we get on that merry-go-round? But you know, the point is, so you've got the point that we have to really look differently at how we provide care, and that it will greatly change. I'm going to talk to you about some of that. And the other thing is that it's very important for you to know that about 80% of my time now is spent in physical health. I go to meetings where there are no other mental health or substance abuse people that are there. And thanks to people like Larez, there are some people even in this room, our health foundations and such, saw the need to have behavioral health at the table and really sort of helped open the door for me to get in there. But we need more help, you know, at those tables. And what's interesting is I was actually welcomed once I got there. It's just that so often we're a thought down the line a little bit. I use the example of healthcare's on the move. It's like a train that's out of the station. I don't want to be in the caboose. I may not be able to get up in the engine, but I want to at least be a boxcar. That's what I'm hoping on, to move us up in the health discussions. But as I go into those meetings, what has become very clear to me is that we are focusing a lot on integrating behavioral health with physical health, and I think that it's a higher priority for behavioral health than it is for physical health right now. And I think that's sort of sad, because if you look at all of this wonderful list of potential coverage that's going to be there, and opportunities for people having, you know, up to 26, I mean, all those different things that are there, my thought is that if you don't include the behavioral health component, we will never see the kind of financial savings that we absolutely have to have. And I want to make sure that you understand that, is that right now, on the average, it's about $500 a month to provide care for somebody who has diabetes. That's a PMPM. This is off of some Milliman studies, an independent actuary. Do you know that if they have untreated depression, the cost is about $1,100 a month? We cannot continue to keep that kind of money on the table. There is what they estimated in their report was that about $300 billion is being left on the table for people who have co-occurring mental health or substance abuse disorders, and they have physical health problems, and it's not being resolved. So let me tell you, I would like to think that we're doing this integration because it's a good thing for patients. I think it is. But I have to tell you that if we don't address this, we will never reach the fiscal needs that are necessary to make this successful. So my hope is to keep being that one noisy voice that's in the room and saying, hey guys, we got to be there with you. And you know what? So far, nobody's told me no. They just haven't thought about it at the front end. And I'm hoping that we can continue to do that. So what we did in our adventure, I got 2 minutes. Oh, this is fun. So in my 2 minutes, I want to say we went on an adventure of trying with our members to start beginning to integrate behavioral health care and physical health care together. We have over 100 sites in Colorado where either the mental health centers are going out into physical health settings. That's everything from the private sector to the FQHCs or whatever. And we also have brought the physical health folks into our facilities, because as you mentioned with medical homes, a lot of our folks see us as their cornerstone provider. And it's really critical for us to begin developing at least baseline physical health and wellness that we have to have in our centers. So with my time constraints, I want to mention to you a couple of things that are very important. We mentioned prevention and earlier intervention. A lot of you are here as your local folks that work on this all the time. You're part of the public health sector. Let me share with you that for us, we have an illness-based system. That what we do is we start treating people after they're already sick. What I'm saying is that our challenge in the behavioral health field is to have wellness as the cornerstone, the literal foundation of how we provide care. Can you imagine? I mean, we are a newer science, but we're old. I mean, we've been around for a while, and for us to change the illness method and begin looking at earlier and wellness as a cornerstone of who we are, it's going to be a challenge. We talked about workforce. I want to share with you, we are wasting, in my mind, up to 30% of our current workforce right now. And how we're wasting it, some of you, if you're bureaucrats, are not going to like this, is the extensive, insane paperwork requirements and such that are in behavioral health. When we try to integrate into physical health settings, they look at us and their faces contort and they go, you guys got to do what for paperwork, or what to report back on, or what to show your outcomes? It is bizarre. And what I'm trying to let you all know is that we have to develop a system where behavioral health and physical health have the same administrative requirements. Literally, folks, 50 to 55% of the behavioral health workforce cannot provide direct care because of all the administrative overhead that we have. It's tragic. So we do need to develop others. The other thing is that we have to develop people that aren't necessarily working with a whole lot of people who have severe illness. What we need to do is start expanding in the area of health behavior specialists. So I'm going to have to look at this real quick and grab the other couple things. I do this, we all do our workshops in multiple longer time than what we have today. But I also want to say that technology, do not underestimate how important that is. This isn't only about electronic health records. That's the first place everybody wants to go because a lot of people don't have them. And if you think we're bad off in behavioral health with electronic health records, it's worse in physical health care. But the key underneath that is the ability to exchange information, the ability to be able to communicate with each other. We do not have enough psychiatrists to be everywhere. But if we can develop a good technology system underneath that, we can, through the use of telehealth, have psychiatry and specialists in places where we couldn't have them before. So don't underestimate how those costs will be. Medicaid expansions. Larez, you're awesome in what you're trying to do with this state. And I just want to say thank you. For us, what we're noticing is this, is that about 40% of the people that we see in the mental health centers that are on our indigent rolls will be covered by the adults with dependent children category. You shared this, and both of you, I think, about why do we need to make sure we've got a comprehensive behavioral health benefit in that, is that now these folks will no longer be eligible for our federal block grant dollars, and so now what we're going to have to do is provide that care to the same people who have serious illness in a different program. And so we've got to be able to have the accessibility about that. And then lastly, this healthcare bill, it's absolutely wonderful, but let us not forget this. In Colorado, we estimate about 288,000 people who still will not have coverage. And the safety net, ourselves, our federally qualified health center friends, you know, our local hospitals and such, we're going to have to deal with that. Those folks are still going to need to be there, and they're going to need help. And so one of the things that we fear is loss of our federal funding for the indigent care, or maybe even in our state for the indigent care, because people are going to think that everyone's all covered now, and that's not going to be necessarily true. So with that, thank you very much, and I'm sure there'll be more discussion as you have questions.
Well, thanks, George. You can see how he is a voice for mental health in our state and how he's embracing the health reforms. Great. So I wanted to leave a little bit of time for questions from you all. I gave him 2 minutes because I knew it might be a little longer than that.
Thought of as mental health. And even recently I received a federal grant for behavioral health, and it only meant mental health. And that was at the federal level. So small department, nevertheless. So I just encourage people who come from, because when you talk about the mind and the body, addiction goes both ways. And And with the because of the chronic nature of it and the co-occurring disorders with mental health. So I just really wanted to put out there that people really think behavioral health is mental health and addiction. Whether they should have been lumped that way at the beginning, hard to say now, that's what we have, but we both need, both silos need seats at that same table.
And that's, and when I speak about behavioral health here in Colorado, I'm talking about mental health and substance use disorder treatment, but yet we probably aren't clear enough about that in our presentation.
Especially for people who don't work right in it.
That's right, thank you very much.
Yes.
Okay, so to kind of depend on that and also to get a specific question answered that might be helpful for us in the audience. So we know that the Medicaid population is challenged by substance use and mental health challenges, in that in order to control costs, we really have to have a program design component that will address those needs, correct? And so my question, and in California, where I'm from, a lot of money is just put in by the California legislature to expand psychosocial rehab and substance use in order to make it more community-oriented, to bring in more paraprofessionals, to make it more community outreach, and to go into communities to do, you know, to kind of have a different model of care. So my question is this. On the federal level, where are the openings to open the program design so that it includes a more psychosocial, less medical approaches and personnel and workforce? And the Colorado level, are you dealing with this at all? Or how are you dealing with it, is a better way to put it?
I mean, I'll jump into Colorado just because I got to ask.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're trying to figure it out. I mean, the fundamental challenge is this has been one of the worst economic downturns for states in the past, we've had to cut $4.5 billion out of our state budget, which is pretty significant. And so we recognize the importance of investing in mental health, and we've made some changes to our substance abuse benefit within Medicaid. It's not nearly enough. I think the changes at the federal level with the essential benefit package and recognizing substance abuse and making sure there's a benefit package will help us better expand that at a state level. But again, we're not coming out of our economic downturn. So part of this is, if the federal government changed it, it would mean states have to change it. But I don't know that you're gonna see, even in Colorado, our recent budget projection is about $1 billion short for this fiscal year, for 11-12. And so we are trying to make no state will say their budget cuts are good cuts. It's just what is necessary to balance the budget.
Yeah, the implementation opportunity might be the healthcare home. So I'm also kind of wondering on state level if there's any way that you might even be able to consider broadening your model of healthcare home. But maybe not, because you have to have money in order to implement it.
It's there, and the concept is there. The problem we have is this. Let's be honest about it. For the early part of this, I mean, I know that if we engage in physical health care, mental health, substance use disorder, where we will save costs, but for the period of time till we get there where the cost savings are, there will be additional costs. And that's the barrier that we have. But I have to also tell you this, in integrated sites, when people are doing integrated care, they look exactly at what you're talking about as being the most important area in order to grow and expand it.
Not everyone in California shares that opinion. Okay.
Well, I'm not saying everybody in Colorado does either, but it's a cornerstone.
It's a learning, yeah.
Ron wants to make one comment.
A couple of comments from the national level to your point. Of the $32 million and the $10.5 million I talked about, there is an excess of persons with substance use problems in that population because they were specifically excluded from SSI enrollment starting in 1998. So if you look in Medicaid nationally now, about 1% to 1.5% of the enrollees, in fact, are people who have a primary substance use condition. 11% have a primary mental health condition. If you let it go up to the prevalence in the population, you would expect that at least, minimally, to be 8 or 9% for people with substance use. So that's point one. Point two, the essential benefit that is required in the Accountable Care Act must include both mental health and substance use. That has not been defined. One of the things I didn't say when I talked, and I'll bring it up here, is that the Institute of Medicine just yesterday issued a request for input into the background on the definition of the essential benefit. We need to all weigh in on both the mental health side and the substance use side of that for exactly the reason you're talking about.
That's good. All right. I'm going to take one more question, and then we'll have a final applause, and then they'll be around for a few minutes, I hope. The woman in red actually was.
There are several related pieces here that I did not talk about. One is the Indian Health Reform Act. The other is the State Children's Health Insurance Program. So both of these also are going forward. We need to pay the same level of attention to these as they happen. A lot of the Indian Health Reform Act is in the hands of the Secretary and the Indian Health Service. The SCHIP program expansion will mean that, in effect, the 32 million people I talked about were only adults. There also are 8 million children who don't have insurance. All of those children are going to be insured through an expansion of the SCHIP prior to 2018, when it will be rolled back into Medicaid. So on both of those issues, you got to go and reach into the office of the secretary, what is going on these issues, because they aren't going to be talked about when you hear presentations on the Affordable Care Act. They're related things, but they aren't the primary action. This is the primary action here.
All right. I want us to thank you one more time. We really appreciated your thoughts and your energy.
Hi, I'm Bill Eaton, and I'm here to talk to you about the Rima LaPouze Award and introduce the speaker for today. First, I want to tell you about the Rima LaPouze Award. First, I want to, is that better? First, can you hear me now? Okay, and in the back, can you hear me now? Okay. First, I want to tell you about the Rima LaPouze Award, then I'll introduce Kung Yi. The Rima LaPouze Award was established in 1972. Rima LaPouze was a child psychiatric epidemiologist, and she was married to Milton Terris, and when she died, he endowed the award. This is the 38th Rima LaPouze Award ceremony in the American Public Health Association. And it is to recognize an individual who has made significant contributions to the scientific understanding of the epidemiology and control of mental disorders. This is the primary award in the field of psychiatric epidemiology. There's no similar award in the Society for Epidemiologic Research, for example. So, in a way, this is the central award, and we use the award in a way to build and recognize the field of psychiatric epidemiology. Selection committee this year consisted of Jane Costello and Bruce Link and Hendrix Brown and Anthony Kouzis. And so we are grateful for them for their work in this effort. And it's traditional, and this is part of the field building exercise, to read the names of the prior awardees. So I'm going to do that. And for those of you on the right hand part of the continuum of the continuous performance test, in other words, with no attentional difficulties, it'll be easy. But I can tell you, if you're on the left-hand side of that continuum, it won't be too hard. It only takes a minute or so. I practiced it beforehand, but I'm going to read all the names. Okay? And then you should recognize them as being the builders of the field of psychiatric epidemiology. So the first one was Warren Dunham in 72, Morton Kramer, Paul Lemkow, Alex Layton, Ernest Grunberg, Ben Pasamanic, Ola Hagnell, Lee Robbins, Norman Sartorius, Barbara and Bruce Dornwind, Jerome Myers, Michael Shepard, Ming Swang, Myrna Weissman, Michael Rutter, Daryl Regeer, Janice Eglund, Evelyn Bromet, Ben Locke, John Wing, Jay Turner, Jane Murphy, George Brown, Dan Offord, Shep Kellum, Ron Kessler, Spiro Manson, Jane Costello, William Eaton, Dan Blazer, Ken Kendler, David Mechanic, Hendrix Brown, Mervyn Susser, Tony Earls, Bruce Link, Afshalom Caspi, and Terry Moffat, Glorisa Canino, and Kung Yi Liang. So there's a little bit of a pantheon quality to those names, I guess. I hope you see that. Now I want to tell you about Kung Yi Liang. Kung Yi was born, brought up in Taiwan, and came and did a dissertation in biostatistics at the University of Washington, Seattle, then moved to biostatistics department at Johns Hopkins for 2 decades and rose to the rank of professor there. he is, I'm not going to go through all the awards he's won. They're the top awards in the field of biostatistics. I think he is internationally known, maybe even the leading biostatistician in the world. And so it's I'm terribly grateful that he accepted the award and also was able to fly here just for this purpose to receive the award and give the lecture. So I looked over Kung Yi's CV. He has about 225 publications. About 75 of them are in the field of psychiatry, psychiatric epidemiology, and about 75 are in other illnesses and health conditions, and about 75, you might say, are in methods and statistics. And the methods and statistics include several breakthroughs. The most important one I think people know is called generalized estimating equations, which he elaborated with Scott Ziegler. That is a method for analyzing longitudinal data that was then used for field surveys and family studies. And it's one of the most important advances in biostatistics over the last several decades. I want to give you a feeling for what Kung Yi is like personally. It'll only take a short second or two. I polled the Department of Biostatistics and other friends for what I should talk about with Kung Yi. So one of the things was duck. And it's not, you know, a directly diversified covariates. It's duck, the bird, the animal, the dish. And so Kung Yi apparently is an expert on duck. I haven't been in this situation, but when the duck is in the vicinity, his behavior changes and he becomes moves toward the autocratic and bossy level and starts taking over the arrangements and discussing the details on the duck apparently. And and of course, duck is brain food. So why don't we learn from Kung Yi and eat more duck and we'll become brainy like him? The other thing is, it's widely rumored in the Department of Biostatistics that Kung Yi doesn't really know how to work computers. When he pets them and says it's not working, but the switch is on the back, you know. But I think this is actually just a false rumor. It's an urban legend, maybe, because as I understand, he spent 2 years in Taiwan and his wife was in Ellicott City, and he would learn somehow or other to control her TV and use the broadcast from that TV in Taiwan. And so his wife would be watching, I suppose, the Hallmark Channel, you know, or the WE Channel or something like that, women's entertainment. And all of a sudden, it would switch to the Orioles game. And so Kung Yi is a big fan of the Orioles. That is something I have no comprehension for, but he is a big fan of the Orioles. And I can tell you one more thing, and that is that it is such a pleasure to collaborate. If you've had the pleasure of collaborating with Kung Yi, it is a wonderful pleasure because you have, on several occasions, I've just had horrible problems, complex statistical problems, and that I just cannot see my way through. It's just a dark mass of chaos. And I visit Kung Yi, and 45 minutes later, it is terribly simple and understandable. It's not always a 2x2 table, but it is, I can understand it. I'm as I say, grateful he's here, and I'm hoping he's going to do the same to this topic of genetic dissection.
Can you hear me in the back?
Yeah.
Thank you, beautiful. You're very kind, colorful introduction. Many things you said actually happened to be true, and I had a wonderful duck dish last night. And and it's also true about me being the Orioles fan. And what's ironic is that for those who are baseball fans, Orioles have been having losing season for 12 years until I left a few months ago, and they're doing pretty well right now. And, so, I'm really honored to be nominated, let alone to receive this prestigious award, and for that I'm really grateful to the selection committee for considering me worthy of this such recognition. And actually, this event allows me to look back my own involvement in the psychiatric epidemiology research. I think probably have to go back to 1989. That was a year my colleague at the Biostate Department of Hopkins, Hendricks Brown, who actually was one of the former recipients of this award, left, choose to leave Hopkins heading south to sunny Florida. And before then, he worked as a biostatistician as one of the projects, a genetic study of schizophrenia led by Ann Pover at the Department of Psychiatry. So he was kind enough to introduce me to the to replace him to be a biostatistician of the project. And then that really, looking back, that really one of the turning points in my career, working closely with the Ann Pover, Jerry Nestad, and other colleagues, I come to appreciate the serious public health issues we're confronting with when we're dealing with the psychiatric disorders. And I was encouraged by Ann to engage in method research for the for genetic linkage study at that time, later on association and others. But probably just important, and she encouraged me to get involved in the training program for biostatisticians interested in mental health. So in 1993, then chairman of Biostat Department, Chuck Rohde, and I apply and luckily receive a training program from NIMH. And so that was a year that Bill and I started working together, and he has a training program in the psychiatry. We have a psychiatric biostatistic. And that was a great run for 10 years. I hope you Bill agree with me, and we work very closely together. We all the trainees met three times a year and work together to critique each other, organize a symposium, inviting leading researchers in the area come to Hopkins. And so there was I think that is very rewarding in the sense that many of trainees actually stay down pursuing research, pursuing mental health research, which I believe that's what the training program is about. So it was a great run for us. And in 1995, and I was involving genetics research of OCD initiated by Jerry Nestad. And it was the first project I involved that I started from day one. And so there are a lot of interesting findings which I'll share with you in a few minutes. So what I'd like to do for the remaining hour is to share with some of my opinions about a topic which is still subject to debate, what I call pitfalls and the challenge when conducting genetic research, genetic dissections. And this is pretty much based on some of the experience I have accumulated last decade to working at Hopkins, in particular with the Ampo for schizophrenia research and Jerry Nestad on the OCD. So for outline, I will focus on the GWAS, Genome-Wide Association Study, and we'll talk about the progress and uncertainty, and the reasons contributing to the uncertainty. And then we're talking about some possible remedy or the lesson they learned. Okay. Then I'm going to talk about some of the genetic psychiatric epi study at Hopkins, in particular OCD study, okay, followed by discussion. I think since the map of human genome was completed in the 2003, the genes for nearly all of the Mendelian disorder have pretty much identified. However, it's considerably a lot more challenging for a complex disease. In fact, to this day, there's no gene for psychiatric disorder has been found. Now, GWAS has become the method of choice searching for gene associated with disease disorder interest, but I probably should mention this with some qualification because things moving rapidly, and this is one of the situation where the science was driven by high tech. And a few years ago, probably the SNPs was the choice for analyzing genetic data, but now the people seem to be moving toward the sequencing. But I hope that the lesson that we learned, the thing we discussed today for GWAS still could be useful for the next phase when people move into the sequencing. So basically, for those who are not too familiar with the area, I think basically for GWAS is the allele frequency, millions of SNPs are compared between the thousands of cases and controls. So the significant, so-called significant, meaning statistically significant SNPs identified and reported. It has become feasible because what the very rapid technological development and dropping in genotyping cost. In terms of progress, and this GWAS have led to the identification of more than 300 genes, gene variation for 70 common diseases. However, many studies failed to come up with the positive finding or failed to be replicated. That's been quite frustrating. And it's particularly for the psychiatric disorders. And also, how positive finding be properly utilized is also less than clear. How can you utilize the finding one report? So what are the issues associated with GWAS in humans, given that people seem to be conducting GWAS nowadays? First, I think probably important for us to be reminded that the markers identified are SNPs, not necessarily genes. So the association through linkage disequilibrium with disease genes. So the one you find may not be the gene, but could be some place close to the true location of the disease genes. Also that the effects of individual SNPs tend to be small. Okay, we'll see example here is this, some of the markers being identified for rare disease. The odds ratio really is range from 1.2 to 1.7, 1.8. They're quite small compared to the majority of environmental variables. So with that, the implications that the false negative is likely because of we don't have sufficient statistical powers. And also the public health impacts are questioned because that will lead to a very small, relatively small attributable risk. And meanwhile, the so-called ethnic stratification or population stratification is still a major potential. So with that, false positive is a strong possibility. Okay. Here's this ongoing study at Hopkins, which I involved, is international study Old Cliff. So, and what you're seeing is that 33,000 SNPs, okay, were genotypes. And this is the principal component one and two, the first two principal components, plotting one against each other. For three populations from the HEMET, okay? So what you see here is that all over different places, suggesting that there's very strong evidence of population stratification. The gray ones are the ones from our study. Again, it's a makeup of several different populations, so they're all over the map. In the meantime, controls are in general not recruited for the original goal of GWAS. And people pay a great deal of attention about collecting, recruiting cases, but much less so about controls. So the comparability between the case and control is sometimes in doubt. And we understand for GWAS, actually the quality of the case and control are just critical. Another issue is about GWAS is that I think it's important to remind that the GWAS is a form of case control study. So it's observational in nature. Okay, so adjusting confounding variables is important. One may argue that while we're doing case control, this is a genes we're comparing with, but meantime there's some So think about smoking as a potential confounding variable, well, which is possible confounding in that there's some genes for smoking addiction being identified in the literature. Okay, so I think this is not just sufficient by comparing the case control, ignoring the potential confounding variables. Okay. Also, the comparability among the cases from different sites may be doubtful. And this is typical. And when you carry now carry GWAS, rely on the participation of a site from many different places. Okay, it's called so-called consortium. And the cases themselves may not be comparable with each other. Okay, again, virtue of a psychiatric disorder to rely on the questionnaire, clinical sign symptoms. Different sites have maybe different diagnosis, different criteria. Okay. So, what happened then? So this is what happened led to such uncertainty. Okay. I think that they're looking back, intentionally or not, the approaches, by that I mean designs and statistical methods, that successful for Mendelian disease were actually utilized when confronting with complex disease. Okay. And we'll come back to this complex disease in a second. Okay. And also there's a lack of an interdisciplinary approach. And the one thing I find that is that for many studies, they're either led by clinicians who may not have strong training in epidemiology, or maybe led by geneticists, may not have strong feel about the phenotypic aspects. Okay. In the meantime, there's a push by NIH in particular to conduct GWAS. Okay. So the notion was that the sample size is what matters, not the quality of phenotypes. So that actually is potentially misleading. Okay. So let me just say something about the complex disease, okay, which probably the one that we're dealing with now. There's some characteristic of the complex disease. One's a lack of clear Mendelian patterns transmission. So gene-gene interaction with small effect for each gene are likely. And then conventionally, one look at one gene at a time, as you might imagine, the statistical power detecting either linkage association with one locus at the time is really compromised. And that's one reason why we have a false negative, just couldn't find the genes. In the meantime, gene-environment interactions is really a norm than exception. Okay? So that means the only exposed group showing evidence of a linkage association, but not the unexposed group. And also this, I think, given that we're in this public health association, it's important to talk about the important public health implication of this gene-environment interaction. So let me just illustrate the 2 points through a couple of examples. And this is, study at Hopkins on oral cleft. What you're seeing here is that for several SNPs, if you look at the all trio together, this is the case parent trio design, the R trace is about 2.1, which is not too small. Okay. But if you stratify by whether the mom smoked during the pregnancy, you see that the much stronger odds ratio or association between this SNP and the risk of oral cleft, okay, when the mom smoked, with the odds ratio 9.0, with about 1.5 for the case when mom did not smoke during the pregnancy. Same is true for another SNP. Okay. So it's very typical for compact disease have this gene-Y interaction. And typically, people look at all the SNP, ignoring interaction. But by doing so, actually, you might miss some of the SNP already by not taking account the potential interaction. And the other example is ApoE and smoking. We all know ApoE is an important gene for Alzheimer's. But it's been reported recently that there's the effect of ApoE on the risk of chronic CHD actually is not among smokers only. So it's another example interaction between gene and smoking. And I think this is a very important public health the message. And what they actually found is that the risk in men who carry the E4 alleles but quit smoking later is lower to the level of non-smokers. What that means is we cannot change your allele, what kind of gene you carry. If you have E4 allele, this is not something you can change. But hopefully we can change your smoking behavior. If you're a smoker, carry E4, But if you can't, when you quit smoking, your actual risk could be lower to the non-smoker level. Okay? So in this case, identified gene-environment interaction helped to put greater emphasis on the benefit of smoking cessation. Okay? There's always benefit by quitting smoking, even though you carry one particular risk allele. Okay? But also helped to identify the subgroup for intervention. So I'll just put some plug about the importance of a gene-Y interaction. Okay. Going back to this characteristic of a compact disease, lack of a clear Mendelian pattern, one of the phenomena is the genomic imprinting, or known as a parent or origin effect. In other words, what happens is only one copy gene pair is expressed, and the expression is determined by the parental origin. So even you carry the allele, but depends on with coming from the father or mother, you might have different effects. Okay. So by ignoring this, actually it could actually lower statistical power finding the gene. The other thing is the aspect is about the genetic and the phenotypic heterogeneity. For genetic, it means a mutation at different loci leading to similar manifestation of traits. So on the surface, on the phenotypic level, they're all similar. But actually, it's different genes, different mutation leading to the same manifestation of the same expression of the phenotypes. The other aspect is about the different genetic etiology for different disease subtypes. Okay. So again, let me illustrate a couple examples. This is an old example. This is the paper published in 1990 in Science, where they report the linkage on chromosome 17 for breast cancer. Which subsequently leading to the BRCA1, the first gene identified for breast cancer. In that paper, they have 23 families. If you look at the last score, which is the conventional method for looking for evidence of a genetic linkage about this particular marker, if you look at all 23 families, the last score is minus 5.5, suggesting no evidence whatsoever about linkage at this marker for breast cancer. However, if you look at the first seven families, they are the one who have early onset for breast cancer. And the last score is almost as high as 6, which is very strong, typical cutoff point of 3. Okay? So it's one example that actually, even for breast cancer, there's such thing as a heterogeneity. Okay? In this case, determined by the onset age. Again, if we ignore such heterogeneity, actually may end with finding nothing. Going back to oral cliff, again, a priori, we've done some study finding out for oral cliff, the different subtypes, cleft lip with or without palate, or cleft palate only. And they're very different etiologically. So in this study, we collect both samples, but we didn't bother to combine together, knowing that they might have different etiology. And sure enough, if you look at the cleft lip with without palate, we have a very strong linkage association finding with the p-value of 10 to minus 15. If you combine both of them together, actually, the statistical power diminishes tremendously. Okay. So speaking about this, about the phenotypic heterogeneity. Okay. And the third aspect about this compact disease is the phenotypic uncertainty. This could be due to diagnostic uncertainty. Again, this is very typical for psychiatric disorder, rely on clinical signs and symptoms. Different region might have different definition about the diagnosis. Okay. So such imprecise distinction between the disease and non-disease could compromise one's power detecting association. Also, disease spectrum, metabolic syndromes for one, and for psychiatric disorder, comorbidity. Should one take into account the comorbidity? For example, the schizophrenia, should we consider bipolar as a part of the spectrum or not? Okay. If so, how should that such information be incorporated? And there's a strong effort searching for the so-called endophenotypes or subtypes for the original phenotype. And the notion endophenotype, the endo is for endogenous, which is quite common in economic literature. In this literature framework, you think about the gene as one end, phenotypes at the other end. And the process leading to from one to the other, sitting in the middle, is something that is called an endophenotype, which hopefully won't be as noisy as the phenotypes that we observe, but closer to the gene. So if one can identify some potential useful endophthalm type, culture can help increase chance finding the gene. Okay. So for example, for schizophrenia, there's such thing as a continuous performance test we introduce as a measure of attention deficit. Okay. So based on that, I think maybe we can ask what kind of lesson we have learned thus far. Okay, well, what kind of challenge we're facing with? Okay. To me, the three things, if I can summarize, it's important that in addition to genetic markers, clinical information for the purpose of subtyping or creating phenotypes, and the demographic environmental variables for the purpose of taking into account the gene by gene interactions of high quality. So it's not sufficient just to measure them, but the quality of such variables is just as important of high quality genotypic variables be collected to deal with a complex disease. Again, we've seen a lot of genetic study that pay tremendous attention to the quality of a genotype, but little attention to the clinical variables or to the environmental variables. Just example, we participated in one of the consortia for schizophrenia. This is European Caucasians. We have a representative from Europe. We had one meeting several years ago deciding whether we should submit a proposal to the NIH to map the 5-centimeter Morgan map. At that time, it was a still linkage study. And sure enough, one of such discussions about the age onset as a potential subtypes. And it turns out the quality of this variable varied tremendously from network collect to the one we have, which is very detailed information about the first episode of psychosis. So for those sites that didn't have the information age onset, then we have throw them away when we look at when we take into account the onset age. Okay. So this is one example where clinical variable actually was ignored and it's part of data collection. Without doing so, to me, that could lead to a negative finding, could lead to small effect, and difficult to be replicated. The other lesson to me is that it's essential to form an interdisciplinary team, bring experts of different fields, including clinicians, geneticists, epidemiologists, biostatisticians, bioinformatics, biomathematicians all together, okay, from the beginning. In fact, the two studies I've involved, schizophrenia and OCD, we have a weekly meeting, and we discuss the science, looking for different aspects, which is really a joint as part of a team. Okay. And we have regular meeting, as I mentioned. And the other thing is to be open mind for and be receptive to the opportunity to collaborate with researchers from other institutes. Make sure we're not territorial, and always good to share the data set and the knowledge with other teams, okay, as means to advance the field. The third lesson to be learned, in my opinion, is that maybe it's time to bring back the family-based design. There was a design choice prior to the post-genome period, which is after the 202. Just a bit of history. Before the DNA polymorphisms, so prior to 1980, linkage study with multiplex disease was the design choice. So by that you need multiple, multiple affected from the same family. And then in 1980-01, association would propose an alternative, okay, based on this article by Rich and Mary Kangas, 1996 Science. And then, meanwhile, in 1993, the work by Spielman et al. Suggests the use of TDT as a means to test the association based on the trio, case-parent trios. So there was a time where the family design was the design choice, but then afterward, now that has become the population-based case control was the design of choice. So before, let me just comment about the why I prefer the family-based design. Just to say the two different types, just let's contrast those two, population-based versus the family-based case control. Really different on how the control was chosen. For population-based, the controls are unrelated to cases, which is conventional case controls. You draw a sample of cases, to assemble unrelated controls, and then compare them in terms of allele frequency. For family base, the relatives of the case are recruited okay, to avoid so-called population stratification. So there's a such, the case parent trio design proposed in 1993, or multiplex family. Okay. So either one, you rely on family data to in order to carry out the association study. And why I prefer the family based design? First, the concern of population stratification we touched upon briefly may be avoided because comparison was done within family. Also, tests of a parent origin is permissible, which is not the case for the, because you need the parental data to do so. And also, underlying genetic mechanism could be tested through segregation analysis, which is not the case for the simple case control design. Testing of clinical variables for subtyping could be conducted. Okay, you have, if you have the cases, you have the relative, for example, the healthy sibling, and hopefully with the control, then you can see if gradation of the endophenotype, then suggests this may be a potential endophenotype. Okay. I jump ahead. This is what I mean by endophenotype. In the meantime, in terms of testing to see whether age onset is important subtyping, then one can divide the cases into two groups. Depends on whether they have early onset or late onset. Then look at the relatives in terms of familial risk. Okay. So with family design, one can answer a lot of questions that may not be otherwise. And so those questions to me are important to prepare yourself looking for the gene. Also, that to a less extent, with the family data, one can estimate the degree of genotypic error. Okay. And also more feasible for disorders such as birth defect. Okay. And for oral club study I mentioned, carried out this is an international study, Taiwan was a part of the site. So we started with the case control study, feasibility. Then before too long, we realized that's not feasible. Because in Taiwan, probably because of the culture, it's always difficult to convince parents of a healthy baby to donate their blood. So we very quickly we switched to the case parent trio designs. Okay. But on the other hand, probably this is less convenient for the late onset disease, such as Alzheimer's, then probably need to rely on the population base because the parents present late onset, presumably parent have passed away already. Okay. Also, for family designs, more likely to assess gene by E interactions. Okay. And also one can perform both linkage and association analysis as they carry out different types of genetic information, okay, to either to refute or replicate findings. Okay. And finally, one can argue that with family data, we actually have a higher genetic loading because we look in the family with at least one or more affected in individuals. So the next 20 minutes, I want to just share with you the study that I've involved initially in 1995, OCD study. So at Hopkins, I've been at Hopkins for 28 years and involving several different genetic epi studies. One Old Cliff, one I mentioned with Terry Beatty, and schizophrenia with Ann Pover. The study was initiated in 1983, but I didn't join until 1980 when Hendrik Brown left. An OC study was initiated in 1995 by Jerry Nestad. Okay. The other thing I did, we have a methodology grant to look into the method for G by E interactions. What I'd like to focus on is the OCD study to illustrate some of the points I made in the last few minutes. So just a background information, obsessive and compulsive disorder is a psychiatric disorder characterized by persistent intrusive thoughts, known as obsession and repetitive action, which is compulsion. Pretty high prevalence in the States, about 2%, compared to 1% for schizophrenia. And clinically, it's known to be a clinically heterogeneous condition, but to this day, unknown cause without specific treatment. And tend to have a young onset. For example, the median onset age is roughly about 11, 12 years old. Okay. And the role of heredity in OCD has long been suspected. Okay, for some the twin studies are suggesting the concordant rate is about 70, 80% for MZ and about 20 to 50% for DZs. However, if you look at the literature, the result of family study has been inconsistent. Again, partially because of the quality of the phenotypes one measures, among other things. So with that, we initially started in 1995. The first fundamental question we ask is that any evidence of familial aggregation. The design we conduct is what I call family case control design. We have identified 80 cases and 73 community controls. And the OCD status of first degree relatives, parents, siblings, okay, so resulting in 343 cases and 300 controls relatives were assessed by psychiatrists and clinical psychologists independently. And what we found, one of the major findings we have at that time is that the risk of OCD among the case relatives is about 12%, as opposed to about 3% for the control relatives. So fourfold increase. So it suggests very strong evidence of familial aggregation. And in fact, this number, 4.7, seemed critical for the subsequent sample size calculation when we carry out the effects of pair design. Okay. So you can see that the one piece of information leading to the next, they all kind of useful next to each other. And for look at focusing on those 80 case families, we divide into two groups, depends on the age onset of the case probands, either younger than 18 or older than 18. Okay. So roughly about 276 case relatives, among them 38 of relatives having OCD amount to 13.8%. Meanwhile, for the relative of older cases, the familial risk is 0%, really suggesting that there may be that actually onset age may be useful for subtyping. Okay, so it's more familiar among families with early onset, which actually is a common phenomenon for complex disease, according to the work by Charles and Scripps. Okay, so with that, we only recruit OCD subject with early onset in subsequent linkage study with multiple families. We're choosing 18 as a cutoff point. Okay. The other thing we'll learn from this families, is about 160 families, is that we can carry out a case segregation analysis. And we actually carry out a very extensive segregation analysis, suggesting that OCD involves major gene conforming to the Mendelian dominant models that's heterogeneous by sex. Actually, the very high, much higher penetrance in female cases than males, which again is quite common for neuropsychiatric disorders. Okay. And actually, if you look at the literature, there's some evidence of clinical etiological heterogeneity by sex. For example, the early onset age for males, and OC personality disorder are more common in males. Also, there's a suggesting association between dopamine receptor, this one, allele, and lower COMS allele with the OCD in the males. So suggesting maybe there's evidence of a heterogeneity between males cases and female cases. So with that, we'll look at a linkage study. There's a gender-specific linkage evidence of OCD on chromosome 11. In 213 multiplex families. When we finished the first phase, look at the evidence of a familial aggregation, look at the evidence of subtyping, and then we start collaborations, okay, inviting researchers from different places, forming a collaborative, what we call OCGS, okay, OCD collaborative genetic studies, ending with the 213 multiplex families. And we find some findings. Then, when going back to the segregation finding, we actually stratified by gender of the cases. We found very, very strong evidence of evidence of chromosome 11, okay, for male probands, whereas there's no evidence whatsoever for females. So let me just show some data. So this is probably difficult for you to make. This is the last score for the for linkage study, and the solid line for males. Probably not so clear for the lighter lines for the females, but you can see here the chromosome 11 is very strong evidence of linkage for male cases. But let's just focus on that chromosome 11. So the last score is above 5 for male cases, if you look at limiting to the male cases, and very little evidence, little evidence for the female cases. Well, may I ask any any prior evidence that the chromosome 15 may be an interesting region for OCD. So again, we look at the literature. If we find that the actual region, including this region, include about two genes involving dopamine pathways, including an impreting region regulating two impreting control regions. Remember, impreting suggesting that the parent origins. Okay, and also contains a cluster of olfactory receptor genes that may be related to OCD. Okay. And this moment, we are continuing our recruitment of 200 case parent trials to conduct GWAS. In the meantime, we're trying to identify the endophilum type for phenotypic refinement. And some lessons we learned, some challenges, the timely recruitment of cases, they are well characterized, which is that's not really easy to identify, especially for the young cases and with the parents involved. And also that the other challenge is how to prioritize and incorporate accumulated knowledge to minimize multiple testing concern and to optimize the chance of a detecting association. We're starting from the beginning, from the scratch, back to 15 years ago, we came a lot of evidence, linkage, segregation. So the question, how you now ready to do the GWAS, how can you utilize this information in a way that hopefully increase your chance for a gene, in the meantime, avoiding the criticism about the multiple testing. I think for the interest of time, I'm going to skip the next few slides. Basically, what I'm saying, we actually collaborate with the basic scientists at the Duke. They have some interest in finding some genes through animal study. And with the help from the NIMH, we're working together. We have the human data. They have some animal study. So we're writing a proposal together, hoping that we can, through this basic science and the clinical and epi data, we can learn, inform each other. So that's another, to me, it's an example suggesting that really genetic epi study actually embrace both a basic clinical to public health research working all together. So I'm going to skip the next few slides. So I'm jumping to the discussion. I think it's well documented that genetic components play important roles in controlling risk of many complex diseases, including psychiatric disorders. Society impacts have been limited thus far. What do you mean by that? And that because it's been difficult to identify genes. And the significant markers are very small effect size, leading to a very small attributable risk. Okay. Also clinical implication, for example, can we find a new treatment based on that? Can we identify the so-called responders, those who respond to the same treatment compared to some who do not respond? Okay. Still a challenge. I think still a lot of work to be done to answer those questions. But I think that we should be very cautious in jumping into the GWAS wagon. Okay, while this seems to be the method of choice for a while, I think to me it's important to ask some fundamental questions first. Any evidence of familial aggregation? Is a disease or disorder considered complex? What demographic and clinical information needed? That's something we think ahead of time. Okay, so I think it would be a lot more difficult if after you study, initiate, and go back to the subject to collecting those information. Okay, it's a lot easier if we do it at the beginning. Okay, also interdisciplinary teams with a close collaboration is really crucial. And consortium may be inevitable because now we need about 1,000 of the cases. Okay, so we need collaboration from different sides, but care is needed. In other words, quality, in particular about the phenotypic information, is not to be compromised. And we're talking about three primary lessons one can learn from this study being done so far. I think important to collect clinical, demographic, and environmental variables. I think it's important to form the interdisciplinary team and also to adopt the family-based design as an alternative to the conventional population-based design in order to tackle the complex disease and disorder. And some of us, Kathy Mary Kangas, Bob Alston, Neil Rich, we're in the process of writing a manuscript. It's a long process, hoping to draw attention to the audience the importance about this, such consideration, and particularly the use of family designs as alternative design. I think that looking back, this line research in genetic and psychiatric disorders is very rewarding in the sense that it provides an opportunity to interact with and to bridge into advanced science of other disciplines by working together. Actually, by when I carry out the research review for the grant that we wrote for gene-wide interaction, I was glad to see that some of the leading environmental health scientists also bring attention to the discipline, saying that now that they need, we need to work harder. Looking at the gene-binding interaction, it's important that we actually provide some markers, or environmental markers, that will be useful when people look at the gene-binding interaction. So in a way, through this research, it's leading to hopefully the advancement of other fields as well. I think it's an opportunity to make a more direct contribution to society. This is one lesson I learned for genetic study, because there's the tremendous implication to the legal healthcare ramification. Okay. Also, that the public health implication through careful examination, G-by-E interactions, just to me, just as important. Okay. I would like to acknowledge some of my colleagues at Hopkins. I just left. Retired from Hopkins a few months ago, joining National Yangming University in Taiwan. But beforehand, but I've been working for many years at Hopkins. The many people want to acknowledge for those in school public health. Charles Rohde was a chair of the department, and I mentioned his name briefly. That we worked together, we submit received a grant, a training program to train biostatisticians interested in mental health. Scott Ziegler, we joined Hopkins the same year, and we worked very closely together developing method, hopefully the useful for public health research. And Terry Beatty, she's the one who introduced me to the area of genetic epi, and we still work together in an oral clip study. And the gentleman of Bill Eaton, we had a good time really working together for two training programs. And there's two research I mentioned, my colleagues at School of Medicine, and she really helps me to get into the psychiatric disorder, to open my eyes, look at how important issues, how big the impact to the society of psychiatric disorders. And I really enjoy working with Jerry on the OCD study altogether. So I'm in debt to them, but more probably just important, I'm really in debt to the Hopkins School of Public Health, which provide the opportunity for me to grow as a researcher, and if I may say, as an educator. And with that, actually, it's given me the opportunity to go back to my motherland, and with hope that I can make some contribution to both college and graduate education. With that, thank you very much. You mean how to, for the late onset disease?
I was just saying, you have a richer set of information seemingly
for the early onset. And ideally, you'd like something comparable, but I don't know what that is, for the later.
Can I interrupt?
Bill's getting another award here.
So it's the environment. That was my question. So you talk about the gene environment interaction, and you know the gene environment, the gene part, it's big, but we know how big it is. We got the Human Genome Project done. We know what it is.
Yeah.
But and we have this work in Viro, for the genome. But the problem is, what is the environment that we should pay attention to? And there was a statistical problem because there's a billion aspects to the environment that we want to have. So if you have, is that your question, sort of? I mean,
you did it much better, Bill. I was just trying to make it a little more concrete in that, I could see that you're capturing things when you do the family analysis, both because you can interview the family, get information from them, and because they represent that environment for, up until, you probably leave the home. And so at least you capture pieces of that. I haven't been sure, you sort of asked the question, well, what's important? But even, if you want to capture something comparable to what you think you might be able to capture from a family about the environment, how would you do that? And it just, it's sort of going from something that seems a little more concrete to kinds of research designs or data collection or development information. And certainly the bearers of the question you said, Bill, what's important?
I think it's remain challenging. As I mentioned, that the people carrying genetic study pay much less attention to what people will, epidemiology will normally pay attention to, such as collection of the environmental variable. When we say environmental, probably what I have in mind is not the conventional one, but including the behavior.
Yeah.
That probably important because they're the one that could be subject to modification. And for psychiatrics, this was interesting for the schizophrenia, OCD. You probably can count the so-called environmental variables in one hand. Very few. Smoking, for example, is not known to be one. Okay, so it's challenging in that regard. But if you widen the spectrum to including a behavior, then you have a better chance to searching for the so-called gene-environment interaction. For later onset, that's more challenging, again, because the family design may not be useful. In that case, because parents actually disease already, but then hopefully that if you can one think about one being behavior, then hopefully you still have the chance to collect those information as well.
So if you tackle Bill's question and said, well, we were doing a new study prospectively, and we were trying to follow. Are there some ways that you could sort of test out pieces of the environmental data or types of environmental data and sort of say, does it look like there's any possibility this is very important, like an OCD or?
E1 study.
I don't even know if the E1
environmental wide association.
Yeah. But I guess, presumably.
There's people behind us here.
Yeah.
An adopted child, that's your index. You have data on the biological parents, both biological parents, and you also have data on the adopted family of the child. So a minimum of five individuals, and that's what's called the Yoke family design. And that can be very, very powerful in teasing apart some of these gene environment issues.
I really don't have much there except wanted to bring your attention again to the importance of a quality of the variable. Taking the oral clip study we have, and look at literature, environmental variable presumably that risk factor to begin with. And some of the leading risk factors are maternal smoking and maternal alcohol consumption. And the literature suggests maybe what happened at the first trimester. But then in this international study, the quality of the wearable really varied tremendously. and also that the rate of smoking varies tremendously from ethnic group to ethnic group. So it's difficult and to measure. Just imagine, especially retrospectively, difficult to ask the mom to recall what happened. And it's not easy, but there's something for us to really keep in mind to the extent possible. Hopefully, that at the onset, ideally, our study would start from the beginning rather than they started differently than trying to put together later on. Okay, then hopefully a better chance to have a high quality environmental variables. Okay. Yeah. I have to say I'm not familiar with the literature in terms of at this cellular level, in terms of imprinting. My knowledge pretty much limited to the allelic level. And for the bipolar, for example, literature suggests there's some evidence of imprinting. And there's actually in the schizophrenia study that I mentioned, we actually carry out bipolar study. And we find that there's apparent origins only carried through the paternal. But not for the maternal. But at the cell, I just don't know well enough about the cellular level in terms of.
Generally, I assume that the same genes are expressed in every cell.
Presumably, yes.
Okay, thanks.